And now as God's word is read and proclaimed, may God fill us with wisdom and insight, and may God lead us. And one of the things I forgot to do because, well, I blame it on being new, but I'm not necessarily, that's the reason why. But I forgot to mention that we have these lavender cards. And if you would fill them out, and if you're it's for visitors. Anybody can fill it out, but it's for a visitor. And if you are a visitor, we'd love for you to fill this out, and you can put it in the offering plate, and then we can make note of your attendance with us this morning. Anyway, I want to start my sermon by telling you about my grandmother. Ines Agnes Pinardi Moreland. I actually had three sets of grandparents. My parents divorced when I was quite young, and I was raised by my stepdad, but my biological father was and still remains a very important part of my life. In fact, in 1989, when I first heard that somebody had written a really controversial book called Heather Has Two Mommies, I didn't get why it was a big deal because I had two dads. Sometimes things have to be spelled out for me. But anyway, despite an overabundance of parents, I only knew one of my grandparents, my stepdad's mother. All of my other grandparents were born before the turn of the 20th century, and they either died young or lived far away, or both. So my only grandparent was Grandmother Ines, my little Italian grandmother, who was born in Vermont soon after her parents immigrated from northern Lombardy and who lived most of her life in Portland, Oregon. She was quite a woman. We called her Grandma Hot Wheels because she always made sure that us kids were in good, had a good supply of toy cars, and we called her Grandma Hot Wheels because she drove too fast. When my older brother and I were getting ready to drive, our grandma decided to get a new car, and so she gave us her old one. It was a 72 Chevy Nova with way too much power under the hood and two bench seats. We were adolescent boys. My grandma knew what she was doing. In fact, I have a few stories about my grandma that would be inappropriate to share even from this pulpit. Suffice it to say that when I was in the fourth grade, I got in trouble for telling one of my grandmother's jokes at school. This was Mendocino in the 70s when such standards about these things were lax. Anyway, my grandma's car was a sweet ride, but unfortunately by the time I got my driver's license, my folks got wise and traded in that Nova for a Ford Escort. In 2001, my grandmother suffered a massive stroke and she died 6 weeks later, holding my sister's hand and talking in the Italian dialect from the Alpine foothills that was her mother tongue. Perhaps she was greeting long-deceased loved ones or awaiting her arrival on Jordan's farther bank. She was 93. Her garden, which was huge and beautiful, and which she tended with no help, was just coming into bloom. In her house that she'd lived in for more than 60 years, in her house, there was nothing that she wasn't currently using. All of her finances were in proper order. And in her purse, there was a valid Oregon driver's license. It's hard to imagine a more graceful exit from life's stage. And in my more than 20 years of pastoral ministry, I have found that when someone dies as my grandmother died, gracefully, and after a long life, it's always tempting to say that we should not be sad. After all, what's not to celebrate about a gentle landing after a long flight? But I'll tell you something. After 13 years, I'm still sad about my grandmother's passing. And I'd venture to guess that I'm not alone here. Everyone who loses a loved one is sad. It doesn't matter how long or how well that person lived, and it doesn't matter how gently they may have gone into that good night. It's always sad when a loved one dies. And that's why I like this morning's lesson from John so much. I've already apologized personally to Al for making him read so long a passage. And Al, I want to apologize even further because really this sermon is about just two words traditionally. The shortest verse in the Bible. Jesus wept. And here's why those tears are so important. When Jesus went to Bethany to perform what is perhaps his greatest miracle, he did so knowing the end of the story. He knew that Lazarus was, to quote Miracle Max and the Princess Bride, only mostly dead. He knew that Lazarus would be walking out of that tomb. He knew Mary and Martha's sorrow would be transformed into incredible joy. And still, Jesus wept. Jesus wept because when a loved one passes, it is an inherently sad event. Regardless of the story that surrounds the deceased's final days, and regardless of what happiness may await the person in his or her heavenly home. And I have to confess that often I am disappointed by the inability of people of faith to practice Christ-like empathy at the time of death. Jesus' empathy was so complete that he cried at the side of a grave that he knew soon would be empty. Meanwhile, far too many people of faith try to avoid grief altogether by sharing platitudes and cliches with one another. He's in a better place, we say, or God needed another angel. Don't have a funeral where we mourn. Have a celebration of life. When his wife, the poet Joy Davidman, died, C.S. Lewis wrote a book called A Grief Observed. And in that book, C.S. Lewis dedicates several pages to expressing his displeasure with the religious cliches people share with those who are mourning. For example, C.S. Lewis writes, and I'm going to read kind of a long passage from it. He says, "Kind people have said to me, she is with God. In one sense, that is most certain. She is, like God, incomprehensible and unimaginable. But I find that this question, however important it may be in itself, is not, after all, very important in relation to grief. Suppose that the earthly lives she and I shared for a few years are in reality only the basis for, or prelude to, or earthly appearance of two unimaginable, supercosmic, eternal somethings. Those somethings could be pictured as spheres or globes where the plane of nature cuts through them. That is, in earthly life, they appear as two circles. Circles are the slices of spheres. Two circles that touched. But those two circles, above all, at the point at which they touched, are the very thing I'm mourning for, homesick for, famished for. You tell me, she goes on, but my heart and body are crying out, come back, come back. Be a circle touching my circle at the plane of nature. But I know this is impossible. I know that the thing I want is exactly the thing I can never get. The old life, the jokes, the drinks, the arguments, the tiny, heartbreaking commonplace. On any view, whatever, to say joy is dead is to say all that is gone. It is a part of the past. And the past is the past, and that is what time means. And time itself is one more name for death. And heaven itself is a state where the former things have passed away. Talk to me about the truth of religion, and I'll listen gladly. Talk to me about the duty of religion, and I'll listen submissively. But don't come talking to me about the consolations of religion, or I shall suspect that you don't understand." Now, because we are a church, because we are a community of faith, comforting one another in times of grief is part of our job. And in my opinion, the best way to do that job is by saying less and crying more. By using our arms to hug more than we use our lips to speak. And no doubt you know this, and you practice it well. I have yet to experience a death in this congregation, but from what I know of you, I am confident that you practice empathy better than most congregations do. And my belief is that the same empathy that we share as a congregation when someone within the church has suffered a loss, that same empathy can and should be brought out into the world beyond the church. And it should mark our lives when we meet human suffering or sadness of any kind. Christ-like empathy must mark our lives. when we think globally, you know, when we encounter, for example, the sadness of a Palestinian farmer whose olive orchard has just been ripped up to make way for a highway on which he cannot drive, or when we think of a child dwelling in a shack on the outskirts of a Latin American city, far from the nearest source of clean drinking water, or if we know of a student here in Oakland who does not have access to a decent education because, as fate would have it, she wasn't born in Marin, and California hasn't figured out an equitable way to share public resources for public education. In the face of such sadness, we could argue about politics in the Middle East, and we could disagree, and we could articulate all of the faults associated with global capitalism, and we could talk endlessly about educational policy, and we should do those things. I am a preacher and a writer. My life revolves around words. And the three issues I just mentioned, the well-being of the Palestinian people, access to water in the developing world, educational policy in California, particularly as it relates to our state's poor communities, these are just three among many issues about which I am passionate, about which I have written and preached, and about which you and I may have disagreements. But here is something I know. If we want to make a difference in the world as people of faith, we must follow the example of Jesus on the road to Bethany. We must lead not with our tears, not with our words. We must lead not with our words, but with our tears. And then we must take action that is rooted in empathy, so that our words, when we do speak, will not take the form of religious cliche or spiritual platitude, but will have power that is grounded in love and nurtured by a desire for justice and driven to work for peace. And so with our tears and our actions, and then finally with our words, we may, in small ways or in large ways, transform the world. Just as we may provide real and meaningful comfort for one another in times of trial and sadness. In a few minutes, we will attend to the sacrament of the Lord's Supper. We will gather around what is meant to be the family table in God's house, where we experience grace in a special way as we reflect on what it means for us to be God's children and part of a family that includes loved ones now past, people like my grandmother, who certainly live on in our memories and in our hearts. And it is a family that extends around the world and includes all of God's children, those whose lives are comfortable and filled with joy, and those who long to feel the power of divine empathy practiced by a church willing, like Jesus, to weep.